The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Now on this week's episode.
Originally, architecture was to shelter us from the elements, but we're creatures of nature, and I think that in our inner souls, we're really more comfortable out in the natural world.
We sit down with Seattle-based architect Jim Olson of Olson Kundig to talk about beauty, nature, and how the built environment should embellish both. Plus, we mull over Making It in the City with a report from London Craft Week. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Seattle-based Jim Olson's career spans 5 decades, but the architect, known for his collaborations with Tom Kundig, decided on his chosen career at the age of 12. But with just $500, a young Olson set out to build his first humble cabin and, unbeknownst to him, set the schematics that would define his gilded career to come. Known for his use of straight lines, tactile finishes, and building residential spaces that frame the surrounding nature, Olson's work deals unapologetically in a commodity that architects have long seemed bashful about using, that of beauty. Olson visited Midori House on the occasion of the publication of a rather fetching new book of his work by Thames and Hudson, and he joined me in the studio to discuss nature, the built environment, and how he started out.
Originally, architecture was to shelter us from the elements, but, you know, we're creatures of nature, and I think that in our inner souls, we're really more comfortable out in the natural world. And so what I always try to do is frame nature and use architecture essentially as a vehicle for helping us feel closer to nature. For instance, with windows where the edges of the glass are hidden so that you really can't tell that there's glass between you and the outdoors, and sort of nicely, more classically proportioned rectangular frames, so when you're inside, the view of nature, whether it's a tree or a distant vista, is framed in such a way that it helps you see it almost as a thing of beauty and also helps you to focus your attention on it, just the way a frame in a museum helps you to focus your attention on a piece of art.
And one thing the book does beautifully is shows the depth and array of your work over the past 6 decades. But I want to, if I may, indulgently, if that's okay, cast you back to very early in your career. I believe you made a decision extremely early that you wanted to be either an artist or an architect. I wonder what made you so determined at such a young age to pursue this vocation.
Well, when I was in, I guess, grade school and junior high school, I wasn't a particularly good student, but I was really good in art. And of course, everybody wants to be special. So that was the thing that I had that made me special. So for quite a while, I wanted to be an artist, but I also loved to build things. And as a kid, we lived in the country and I built forts in the woods and those kinds of things. And so the idea of loving to build things and loving art and to make art kind of morphed into architecture. And I think about when I was maybe 12 or 14, I decided that I wanted to be an architect. And I never changed my mind after that. And I'm so happy I didn't.
So the vocation didn't change, but I wonder if your preoccupations as a practitioner have, the set of things that you're most interested in doing with your buildings and your structures, are they broadly the same as they were when you started out? Or do you have a new set of things that keep you curious or ideas that you want to bring to bear?
You know, I think the first building that I did, I was 18 years old and my dad gave me $500 and he asked me to go and build a hut in the woods, and it would be basically a bunkhouse for the teenagers to sleep on my grandparents' vacation property on Puget Sound in the Northwest. And that was essentially the best thing that ever happened to my career. I was able to select a site on a hillside surrounded by trees that looked through the trees out to the water below. And I wanted to do a building that literally set itself down gently onto the forest floor on posts, and all the trees were saved, and it basically worked itself into the existing tree structure. Actually, my feeling as a child was what later I learned is what, say, Japanese pavilions in nature are all about. It's a place where you go to just be one with the forest. And that was my idea as a kid. And honestly, I don't know how it came about. I think that I just spent so much time outdoors. But that philosophy has essentially stayed with me because I'm so tuned to looking at nature. I want other people to do the same. And so what's developed out of the idea for this first little building basically stayed with me through my whole life. But what has changed are the sort of the many ways you can do this. So I think that what's happened is my architecture has just become more and more refined and leading people to focus their attention on art pieces in such a way where the architecture, maybe columns and beams, frame a piece of art. They're like an extension of the actual frame of the piece of art. And it, again, helps you to really focus your attention just on that one piece. So I guess my dream is that people will, you know, just sit quietly and really contemplate and get into the spirit of an art piece or something in the natural world. I see those two as kind of being similar.
And you mentioned a few things there. You mentioned continuity and you mentioned framing things, which bring me on to the idea of the straight line, which has been one of the few things that has woven a kind of thread through all of your work. And the straight line isn't uncontroversial in architecture. If you think about the move from Art Nouveau to Art Deco, if you think about people like Hundertwasser, the artist, he said the straight line is godless. What's your fascination with the straight line? Because that does appear to be one aspect of your work as an observer that has had great continuity.
What I basically want to do with the straight lines are create a contrast with the organic nature of the natural world and also with most art and sculpture. And so by creating a very simple frame that is rectangular, you, by contrast, really bring out the shapes in organic forms, whether it's nature or art. And to me, that's really important. I think the straight line, if you look in nature, for instance, a body of water with an island beyond, the straight line that is formed by the body of water actually helps describe the shape of the island. And in our case, we have a mountain across from our property, and you notice that the straight line of the water actually enhances the shape of that mountain. So it's by contrast. If all the world were straight lines, then I'd want to be doing curves.
I think that's a great answer. I want to use a word that I don't particularly like, but I think it is a useful word, materiality, the haptic experience, the tactile experience, your great use of natural materials and maybe a tendency to leave a few rough edges or something that you can actually touch and hold on to is another kind of earmark of your work. Why do you think that's important?
I love nature. And in the natural world, we get all sorts of layers and a variety of textures in, you know, leaf shapes, leaf forms, all that. And I think it's, again, part of who we really are. And so to me, allowing architecture to, you know, have that texture and weathered quality makes it more real, makes it more authentic. You know, weathered wood where you see the grain, or stone where the stones are either a little bit rough or the various stones aren't exactly the same color and you get that texture. It just brings it to life. And, you know, think of the texture like in a body of water, and when the wind comes across it, you get these beautiful little ripples and waves and reflections. And that's what brings things to life. And when the sun hits a textured wall compared to a smooth wall, you get the little shadows and they change during the day. I think it's just more part accepting the fact that we're part of the natural world. Although, I mean, there are times when a pure, simple, refined material is the right thing when there's a lot of texture around it. And then you play off of that so to achieve a contrast. But I think there's a beauty just into how things weather naturally. Quite often, say, in a say floors, and people are worried about their kids ruining the floors. Well, if you start out with the floors being either, you know, recycled and rough or whatever, and they end up looking better the more they get beat up. You know, like everyone loves antiques and we love old things and old houses and old bridges and all this. And that's what makes them so great, is the wear and tear over the years gives them character.
Architecture is often associated with the words form and function, and they become something of a cliche. I quite like the word beauty. Do you think that's used enough in architecture nowadays? Do you think the aspiration for beauty rather than, say, adornment? Should we be using the word beauty, and should we be seeking to create beautiful structures?
Absolutely. I'm not ashamed of wanting to make my architecture as beautiful as I can. And I think that beauty does something to your soul. And when you see something that is truly beautiful, you get this kind of warm glow inside that comes from that. The same with music or, you know, a beautiful writing or something like that. But architecture really does that. And to me, there are a lot of things. It's composition, proportion. I happen to like, you know, traditional classical proportions. You know, the use of materials and colors and how they work together, textures, all those things do make beauty. And I know that, say, in art and architecture and various things, there are people who think that, oh, beauty's not enough, as though beauty is some kind of superficial thing. Beauty is the ultimate joyful thing in life. And I think we should move toward it instead of being afraid of it.
What would be your dream commission, Jim?
You know, really my dream commission is to build a structure that is essentially created just to house an amazing collection of something. And whether it's antiquities or contemporary art or even horticulture or something like that, for an individual who is a true connoisseur of whatever that is, and to make it the perfect solution for that passion and of interest. And then I do so many things similar, actually sort of like that, for private individuals, and they enjoy them. And to me, to be able to do that for a building that will become public is essentially my dream.
Architect Jim Olson there, speaking to me a little earlier. Thames & Hudson's new book, Jim Olson, Building Nature Art, is available now at all self-respecting bookshops. As consumers, we're increasingly concerned with the provenance of our products. But is it still possible to make things in the city? Surely the relative paucity of space and higher expenses are crimping craft folk in the British capital. Well, not if the participants of this year's fourth annual London Craft Week are to be believed. From pottery to weaving and glassblowing, independent makers demonstrated their skills to the public. Monocle's Hester Underhill went to meet some of them, along with the events director.
Last week saw the launch of the fourth edition of London Craft Week, a yearly event celebrating the best of contemporary and heritage craftsmanship from the UK and around the world. With an array of events, talks, workshops, pop-up exhibitions and displays taking place around the capital, over its five-day run, the festival brings visitors and independent makers together with galleries, shops and studios, inviting them to explore the art of making. From established names like milliner Philip Tracy and furniture designer John Makepeace, to young and emerging talent, the week puts a spotlight on quality manufacturing in an era of throwaway consumerism. I headed down to Mayfair to speak with the festival's director about what this week means to its participating talent and why it's so important to keep the art of craft alive.
So my name's Jonathan Burton and I'm the festival director for London Craft Week. This is our fourth year and the event's grown enormously in a very short space of time. I think from around 60 events in the first year to, I think, 227 this year. So I think the reason that people are kind of interested in craft is twofold. I think people are moving away from more disposable products, but also I think we see people as becoming slightly more discerning. Actually, we're interested in the kind of making process, buying pieces of quality, pieces that somehow have a story and substance to them, pieces that they're going to own for some time. So there's a sort of piece around sustainability as well. You've clearly got quite a lot of young people, actually people in their 20s. And I think that's interesting. I think that you kind of see people who are obviously concerned with kind of the skills associated with a wide range of crafts. But I think similarly, that kind of socioeconomic backstory, you know, wanting to kind of see pieces that are either environmentally friendly because actually they are sustainable, that move away from kind of disposable products. But also I think because people are interested in learning new skills. If we say that people are more discerning, that's also because they're able to kind of research things so much more easily now. So both around how products are made, where they're sourced, the materials that are involved. So you see people kind of educating themselves, but actually nothing then replaces meeting the maker face to face and seeing them demonstrate. London clearly is such a kind of cultural hub and a global city, and therefore, you know, that creativity shines through in such a range of craft as well, both independent makers. And with London Craft Week, we've got 275 independent makers taking part, which by any measure is, you know, it's a strong platform for people looking to present their work, tell the story of their work and hopefully make sales. But also the other thing that covers, you know, the whole week is really a story about kind of spotlighting makers. And that's true similarly then with kind of luxury brands as well. It creates an opportunity for well-known brands to bring this sort of unsung heroes and heroines of those organisations to the fore and allow them to demonstrate their skills. So you get kind of, you know, organisations like Mulberry and John Smedley and Vivienne Westwood as well being able to kind of foreground that making element to their work.
After speaking with Jonathan, I made a trip down to Dunhill's Borden House to meet some of the makers putting the process of producing their wares on display as part of the week's carefully curated roster of interactive displays. I spoke to weaver Maria Sigma about her brand in collaboration with London Craft Week.
The brand actually started 2 to 3 years ago when I received the Cockpitas Cloth Workers Award. It's an award for weavers, and they provide weavers in their first steps with studio sew and looms to sew as well. And I was a resident at Cockpitas in Deptford for 2 years. They also give you business support. And this is how I started building up slowly the brand. After these 2 years, I bought my own loom, as you can see. And I moved in studio in East London. I got the support from Princess Trust and Virgin Startup. So since actually last September, I officially launched Maria Sigma Woven Textiles. The philosophy behind is to make hand-woven textiles, zero-waste textiles, ethically made with natural and dyed materials, mainly using wool, natural and dyed British wool.
Do you think London's a good place to be as an independent maker?
Yes and no, both with capitals. Yes, because everything is happening here. You get support, you get inspiration, you can have amazing collaborations with people from different disciplines and fields. You can have events like this one, as for example, trade shows, great exposure. But on the other side, actually, it's very expensive to live in London. And be a maker, independent maker, means that you need your working space. And be a craftsman, again, it's a luxury because everything's going very, very slowly. So, yeah, negatives and positives.
Is this your first year at London Craft Week?
Yes, it's my first year on London Craft Week. I have been in London Design Festival with Cockpit Arts 2 years ago. And to new designers 1 year on, when I first started. But yes, for London Craft Week, this is first time.
And how are you finding it?
It's amazing to be in that building. It has a great tradition and heritage in craftsmanship, which is really important. They have really skilled leather craftsmen. All the makers came for these days are really good makers. It's really beautiful and amazing to be involved in that. I'm very lucky.
So can you show us a bit around your space and explain your setup a bit?
So the space has been set up to work as a studio space. I have almost anything I use in my studio. Beautifully displayed, it's not normally like that. So you can see the loom in the center of the room, big loom, which takes most of the space, and all the work is done here. On the back is the warping mill, is the first step in order to set up the loom. So you wind your warp there, that makes the length of the warp and the setup of the warp. Then you beam it on the back of the loom. You thread it through the handles one by one, and then you tie up on the front and you start weaving. And then after that you cut off, you wash the cloth, you stitch it around, cut the loose ends and brass it and steam it.
So it's quite a labour-intensive process.
Yes, it is. To produce a throw, for example, you need like 2-3 days to set up the loom, and then 3 days to weave, and 1 day to wash, stitch, brass and steam.
Another independent maker showing off his craftsmanship as part of the week's series of events and displays was London-based glassblower Michael Rue, who told me a bit about what he was up to at the festival.
The setup here at Dunhill Boarding House for London Craft Week is a mobile studio which I've hired from a friend of mine out in the West Country. And it's a studio which is perfectly adapted to situations like this. So it gives us some mobility to work in places, show glassmaking to people we wouldn't normally be able to access. This isn't our first year at London Craft Week. We've participated in some events which we hosted in our own studio. Last year we had a session where we were showing glassmaking and techniques to interior designers and architects, showing them the types of things that we can make in glass and perhaps more in general for architects and designers, how they can work with us. I think London is a fantastic place to be a maker because there's access here to so many different types of clients, and what we find as well is that now the longer we've been in business as glassmakers, more and more people are coming to us. More and more local London shops and businesses, designers, architects are coming to us. And I think that those opportunities would perhaps be more difficult to encounter if we were in a more remote location. Last evening was the first time I've ever used this furnace, and it was ramajama with people here, so I was a little bit nervous and a little bit tenuous about working as well, so I just made some very, very simple drinking vessels. Even with making really simple drinking vessels, the thing that always surprises me when we have the public watching us is how apparent it becomes the process that's involved in even just making the simplest of objects. It's at moments like that where I realize how much work, so to say, goes into even just a very simple object. And I think people who are watching us as well appreciate what's involved in making an apparently simple object. So,
how hot is it inside the furnace?
The furnace is burning at around 1,100 degrees, maybe a bit hotter than that.
So, Fahrenheit?
C.
So nowadays, the term craft is quite like a loaded word. It has a lot of connotations, both positive and negative. How do you think London Craft Week fights against people's preconceptions of what craft is?
What I hope we do is that by presenting both independent makers, smaller brands, alongside very established names, we're able to kind of bring out the thing that they all share. And that's about making, and it's about the craftspeople that are at the heart of those businesses. I think what it shows, particularly with independent makers, is that whilst the works that they're producing may not be either incredibly expensive or necessarily famous, there is still a luxury to kind of the products that they're producing. In the same way that craft can be a loaded term, luxury similarly can be. There's luxury in the skills and making of a bespoke work, whether it's ceramics or textiles or woodcrafting, luxury is kind of inherent to that. We're buying into something where someone has expressed themselves creatively through those materials. And what I hope as well is that, you know, in buying those pieces, it sort of expresses something about ourselves. You know, it's about personal signifiers. We buy things because they say something, they speak to us. And I think buying crafted work in that way enables people to express themselves too.
For Monocle in London, I'm Hester Underhill.
Sincere thanks to Monocle's Hester Underhill, reporting there from London Craft Week. Next week...
Before Michael Tonnet had the idea of mass-producing furniture, you had to go to a carpentry, and then you would have to wait at least half a year for your chair or table to get produced. Well, Michael Tonnet revolutionized or industrialized that process.
We sit down and acknowledge the canny design behind the archetypal steam-bent Viennese cafe chair. Still manufactured by the original designer's family, Tonnet is still sturdy after six generations. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis, researched by Miriana Legrasta, and edited by a whole host of talented folks at Midori House, including Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
See what I was saying. See what I was saying.